Evening, everybody. How are we doing? Yeah, two or three of us are all right. How's everybody else? Yeah, fine, good. I've still got a sore throat. So if you've been sort of following the mini-series of Matt's sore throat, we're now 6 weeks in and I can't shake it. So, yeah, I'm just sort of getting used to that. Thank you. A little bit of sympathy. Thank you. Oh, it's nice when that happens. Yeah, Ruth, you could learn from your husband there, giving me some sympathy. Right, yeah. That's not because I'm a boss or anything. I'm getting that sympathy. Okay, so on this Remembrance Sunday, we, of course, as we did earlier, we remember people who gave up their lives or at least a lot of comfort to serve and protect other people, don't we? And actually, interesting, I didn't know it was going to come up, but the whole thing with Brother Andrew, in a very different way, gave up his comfort and often safety to do something to serve other people. And we admire people who do this sort of thing, don't we? We admire people who are self-sacrificial in some way. And it's incredible. And it's sort of a coincidence, you might say, that today we're looking at a Bible passage that is very much on that theme. This is part of our Radical King series on Matthew's Gospel. We're now in the middle of chapter 20 out of chapter 28. And at this point in the story, Jesus is traveling towards Jerusalem, and it's where the whole thing is going to come to a head. So Jerusalem is where the sort of final act of the story is. But on the way there, Jesus has this chat that we're going to see today with his disciples, and it's very revealing about him, but also about what human nature is like. Here's what happens. Now Jesus was going up to Jerusalem. On the way, he took the 12 aside and said to them, "We're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death, and will hand him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. On the third day, he will be raised to life." Now, throughout Matthew's Gospel, there's all sorts of incredible stories about Jesus. But as we get later in the story, on three different occasions, Jesus sort of stops what's going on, takes his disciples to one side, and says something like this paragraph. He does it in chapter 16, he does it in chapter 17, and here in chapter 20, he does it again, each time with more detail. And now that he's approaching Jerusalem, the big thing approaches, the most important thing that's ever happened in history is about to happen. And Jesus knows this. He knows what's coming. And he knows it's going to be a terrible ordeal for him. But he continues on. He does not turn away from Jerusalem. You know, I'd be like, okay, I'm going to walk in the direction. This sounds terrible. Jesus keeps going. When people think of Jesus, they often think, oh, Jesus, you know, he's sort of weak and mild and blah, blah. No. He knowingly and deliberately walks into certain death for the sake of other people. When we worship Jesus, we worship someone with unbelievable courage and resolve. And he knows what's going to happen. And he tells his disciples, as we see here, his inner circle of followers. And I'm just going to break down what he just said in that paragraph because it's important. It matters enough that he keeps telling them, okay? So you can see there a sort of list of things that happen. Firstly, he calls himself the Son of Man, which is a strange title based on some words in Daniel in the Old Testament. And the idea is, in Daniel, the Son of Man was sent by God as somebody who appeared human like everybody else, was human, but there was more to him. And Jesus keeps using this Son of Man title about himself as if to say, I am this person who looks human, who is human, but he's also something more, something special, something extra. And the big idea is that God sends this Son of Man into the world for our benefit. Good start. But next it says, or Jesus says, he would be delivered, which he was, by one of his disciples in this very conversation who was there. Judas delivered him into the hands of the Jewish religious leaders. They were the sort of authorities on these matters. It was they who then condemned Jesus in a sham trial. Because the Jews did not have the authority to carry out capital punishment, they handed him over to the Gentiles. They got the Romans involved because they were the bosses. This is a reminder, I should say, by the way, that at times in history, people have blamed the Jewish people for killing Jesus, but actually, it was the Gentiles that physically carried it out. It was Romans that killed Jesus, although it was the Jewish leaders and the crowds that wanted them to, telling us it was humanity that killed Jesus. It was not about one race in particular. It was people that killed Jesus. Then Jesus would be mocked and flogged, a huge physical and psychological ordeal. And we often miss this because of what comes next. But this was bad in itself. I mean, lots of people died just from flogging. That's how horrible, how violent it was. Jesus went a bit further, though, and finally was crucified. Crucifixion was a particular Roman way of executing somebody, nailing them to a cross so that death was slow and painful and public. One thing about crucifixion that I think is significant here is that unlike most other ways of killing people, you cannot possibly do it to yourself. You physically cannot crucify yourself. You can shoot yourself. Well, you couldn't then, but you can now. You can hang yourself. You can electrocute yourself. You can throw yourself off a building. But it's physically impossible to crucify yourself. You can't do it. And that means there's no ambiguity. Although Jesus knows this is coming and chooses to do it, there's no sense in which he does this to himself. People killed Jesus, and they did so deliberately. And so it's all very bleak. But then when Jesus tells them what's coming, he adds one thing. He would on the third day be raised. Not by any human, of course, but by God. Meaning the awfulness of the cross and why it happened is met with the miraculous joy that Jesus is raised from death a few days later. And so through this, you can see what happens. All that we, humanity, contribute is we deliver and condemn and hand over and mock and flog and crucify God's Son. God sends him to us for our sake. God raises him at the end. In between, our stellar contribution as a species is that we do bad stuff to him. That's what we bring to the table. And the human attitude to God is captured in those words. I didn't literally kill Jesus, of course, but at the same time, in my own way, I participated. I participate, as we all do. You may wonder, though, why does Jesus keep telling his disciples that this is coming? And why does Matthew, who wrote this book, keep telling us about it when the book itself actually finishes with all of this in more detail? It's like he's giving us huge spoilers before the big ending. Well, what happens next in the passage, I think, tells us why. It's because Jesus wants to set a template, a model for what following him looks like. Because people just don't get it. Either back then or right now, people don't get it. Let's read what happens next. And the disciples are just on a completely different planet to Jesus. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favor of him. "What is it you want?" he asked. She said, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom." This is such a crazy response to what Jesus has just said. And it tells us why he had to say it. The disciples are not thinking, it would seem, "That's incredible. He's going to die and he's going to rise. What? I'm going to have to think about that." Or, you know, at least, you know, if this is what he's going to do, maybe I should support him in some way. Maybe I should offer some help in some form. No. Zebedee's sons, that's actually the guys called James and John, send their mum. They don't even come on their own. They send their mum to ask if they can have a very prestigious position in Jesus' future kingdom. That's what sitting on the right and the left would mean. Despite what Jesus has literally just said, they're thinking about power and prestige and position. They know Jesus really well, so probably they're thinking, well, we're in with a good shout. We know him really well, so if this all turns out well, we're in a good position. It's a little bit like if you were really good friends with the person who becomes prime minister, you might think, well, chancellor, home secretary, could be in with a shout, sitting at the right or left. It's on the cards if I maneuver myself properly. Although the way things are right now, probably all of us are going to get a go at being chancellor at some point, aren't we, in the next few years. But you might read this and think, "What? These guys are just so insensitive. Jesus just told them he's going to suffer and he's going to have this terrible thing, he's going to die. And now they're asking favors about who gets to sort of sit next to him. What? But the disciples are all of us. Whenever they appear in the story, they're just so human and normal, just like all of us. Well, most of us. We might not pray prayers asking to sit at Jesus' right or at his left, but let's be honest, we have our own priorities and emphases that are nothing to do with the path that he talks about here. The Jesus model is an uncomfortable level of self-sacrifice. But we get distracted. Christians get distracted by so many other things. I actually made a very quick list. This is not comprehensive. Here's some things I think Christians get distracted by rather than the way of Jesus, okay? And they're good things, mostly. Okay, we get distracted by secondary theological issues. So thoughts on, do we baptize only children or only grown-ups or both or you know what? We think about whether we should have women in leadership. We've been talking about that a bit as a church. We talk about sexuality. We talk about the environment. There's loads of things that are important to talk about and right to talk about, but we have a tendency as Christians to just put them that little bit above where Jesus should be. Another one might be worship style. What sort of worship do we prefer? Do we use charismatic gifts? Should we be looking to have nice experiences? Are we, have you ever heard that question, are we enjoying church? It's bizarre, isn't it? I don't see anybody in the Bible talking about whether they enjoyed church. We seem to talk about it absolutely loads. We talk about church activities. We've got loads of brilliant church activities at Maybridge, loads of them. And we should talk about those and we should get on with those. But we have a tendency to make them the thing that we focus on most. Or relationships. What could be bad about relationships? Relationships are fantastic. We want to be a warm and welcoming community. We use those sort of words. Often we put that as the thing that we think of most. Our politics, whether it's on the left or on the right, and seemingly in our culture you have to be on the left or on the right about everything, and then we have to all argue about it on the internet. Apparently, I don't really want to do that. I don't know about you. But we make politics, I've noticed in church, above Jesus quite often. Or it could even just be being a nice person. Very simply, we focus on our own morality, our own niceness, how we're behaving above Jesus. Cultural engagement. This is very fashionable about at the moment, isn't it? Thinking about how we understand the culture around us, how as Christians we share what we believe and why and all sorts of different things and how we act and how we behave and how we include people. All really good stuff to think about. It's an enormous world of stuff to think about. We often put it above Jesus. And finally, it can be just that we put God's voice or direction for our own pursuit above Jesus. Before we've even started thinking about what he says or what he models, we're thinking, well, what do I fancy doing with my life? And what should my year look like? And what are my holiday plans? And what do I think church should be? And what's God saying to me about me for me? Because I want to know more about me. A few people are nodding. You recognize this. With all of these things and many more, we put them very much above the words of Jesus and what he models in this passage. Good things, many of these good things, but we miss the point. The Christian life at heart is humbly following the way of Jesus and serving and even suffering. It's serving, suffering. If it's not about that, we've missed it. We've made it into something else, usually something very English and middle class. In light of this, look at how Jesus responds to this request for the good seats in the kingdom. You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said to them. Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared by my Father. You don't know what you're asking, he says. In other words, you don't get it. You don't know what this is about. When he talks about the cup, it's quite strange to us. The cup was used as a metaphor in the Old Testament. It's sometimes referred to receiving great blessing, but more often it was a metaphor for judgment or suffering. And Jesus uses this picture to represent what he's going to do, what he's about on the cross. Taking on the judgment and suffering of others, but so that blessing or goodness, in our words, would come to those people. That was huge. The mission he's on is huge. But the disciples probably just think, well, this cup thing, Jesus is probably just talking about being a bit unpopular, being a bit rejected. Yeah, we're okay with that, Jesus. We'll get on with that. That's fine. But he knows, even though they don't understand right now, they will drink the cup, so to speak. And we know from history that James and John later on did get it, and their fate was that James was actually executed and John was exiled for their faith. Eventually the message did go in and they lived it out. The stakes are high and Jesus does not at all shy away from that. Then the passage continues. When the 10 heard about this is the 10 other disciples, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Very predictably and very humanly, the other disciples get wind of this conversation and they don't like it and they come steaming in. And Jesus immediately speaks into it. He understands the dynamic here is clamoring for power and prestige. Everybody wants position. They want to be seen as great. And so what Jesus does is completely reverses how everybody thinks about power and greatness and leadership. And it's so countercultural that it's still countercultural now. 2,000 years later, it's still countercultural. There's two parts. First, he says, to be great, you've got to be like a servant. And a servant was somebody who, you know, day to day could have no real ambition for their own glory. Their job was to attend to the needs of other people. And the idea of a servant is one that we maybe can get behind. Christians talk a lot about the idea of a servant leader. That sounds good, doesn't it? And it is a good thing, being a servant leader, someone who leads by serving. Very attractive idea. But Jesus goes a step further even than that. Because second, he says, to be first, you've got to be like a slave. To be first, you've got to be like a slave. And it's quite shocking. Now, we have to remember, being a slave in the first century was not exactly the same as modern slavery that we have in the world now, and which is universally terrible. But first century slaves did not have rights or power or agency. They had to submit their agendas, and in fact their whole lives, to whoever owned them. And basically, from when they woke up to when they went to bed, the only question was, how do I make my owner's life better? Mostly by doing what they want, but how do I make my owner's life better? And so Jesus says, in my kingdom, in my world, that attitude is how you become first. Seeing yourself as a slave to others is how you become great. That's the true greatness. Not being a doormat, not saying, oh, I don't matter, but at heart, walking into a room and thinking, how do I totally submit my ways for the sake and the good of other people who are here? Just imagine that. Imagine if a few people live that way. This is an uncomfortable level of service. Not many people are queuing up to do it. In fact, I would argue nobody can do this unless you see your life as under the rule of a God who's already served you far beyond this. You see, Jesus never asks us to do something that he doesn't first model. On the cross, he lowers himself to the level below a slave, to a people that treat him like filth. And yet that last line again, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. On the cross, Jesus said that he paid a ransom. This has actually become quite an old and complicated theological question. Who was Jesus paying this ransom to? And there's all sorts of theories, but more important than the who it was to, it was who it was for. The great Bible commentator William Barclay says, a ransom is something paid or given to liberate a man from a situation from which it's impossible to free himself. A ransom is something paid or given to liberate a man from a situation from which it's impossible to free himself. The Greek word for ransom, litron, which is used here, was a term used to describe the purchase price for freeing a slave. The Jews of Jesus' time were used to a sacrificial system in which animals were used to pay for the sins of the people. And so the idea of some sort of sacrifice being needed for sin was baked into their culture. It's all through the Old Testament. It's all a build-up to Jesus. And now he says he will give his own life as a ransom, a purchase for many. He will literally give up his very self to purchase other people, his life in exchange for ours. And so Jesus models extreme, radical service and sacrifice for his disciples. But at the end, he does something that they can't do. Only Jesus can become less than a slave to serve as a ransom for many. Nobody else could have done it. But he did. How are we supposed to respond to this? I've got a couple of really complicated words here. Firstly, I think one application of this, obviously, is to serve. It seems so simple. I would imagine nobody disagrees that serving other people is a good thing to do, that it's a noble idea. But as we've seen, we get sidetracked by so many other things, and often even our serving, our outward serving, if we're honest, is actually an inward way that we're serving ourselves. We're meeting our own needs by doing things that feel virtuous. And so let me ask, what is your orientation to serving right now? Think about your work, your family, your friends, maybe your partnership group. When you show up here on a Sunday, are you looking to serve? And I don't only mean being in a team like refreshments or tech or welcome, all really good things. They're not the only way to serve. I mean serve in how you talk to people, in what you're trying to get from conversations, in who you choose to talk to. Because serving is not just a task. It's, to use modern language, it's an orientation. It's an orientation. It's a posture that we do or do not take. And if the way of Jesus is primarily about serving, has that attitude got a hold of you right now? Are you someone who serves at heart right now? If not, well, maybe my second thought answers that somewhat too, which is we need to be served. I don't think we can serve until we know we're being served, and being served by Jesus. Let me ask, do you know the story? How thoroughly do you know it if you do? Do you know what happened on the cross or much of the detail on why it happened? Your and my attempts at serving other people will only be driven by duty and obligation, and it will become bitterness unless you have the perspective, and I have the perspective of Jesus first serving us front and center. If you don't think of him serving you first, serving will always become duty and obligation and ultimately bitterness. I thoroughly believe that. If you've been a Christian for a while, let's be honest, it's tempting to be complacent about all of this stuff about the cross and sacrificing yourself. Well, I know this. I've heard this so many times over the years. But what Jesus did is the absolute center of our faith. He certainly thought so. He spoke about it repeatedly, even before it happened. Most of the New Testament, if you read it, is a reflection on what happened on the cross and what it means. If you're the sort of person who reads and you want to think more deeply, I recommend the classic John Stott book, The Cross of Christ. Fairly readable. It's all about what the cross is about. Why it happened. What was Jesus doing? If you're less of a reader, The Bible Project has some really good short videos. Just Google it. About what the cross meant. I do recommend on the back of this evening, just spending that time again, long or short, dwelling on, okay, maybe I've been around church for a while, maybe I've been a Christian for years and years. Do I really have a hold of what the cross is all about, really? How can my understanding of that go up a notch? But what Jesus is saying in this passage, in a nutshell, is this. It's not about you. The hero of this story is me. The model for how to live is not what the rest of our culture says, it's him. All the reassurance and the challenge that comes from what he says in this passage. He's the hero of the story. Let's not be distracted or deterred by anything else. He is the model, he is the pattern for his people to live by. And he's the one that we're supposed to worship. So let's continue to just do that right now.